This week, black gold finished higher while most U.S. markets consolidated. Well, welcome back to Gold Seek, everyone. Your host here, Chris Waltzek. We have another big show lined up. Two more top industry guest experts. With Fed policymakers scheduled to ratchet up rates yet again next week, Gerald Celente joins me from the Trends Research Institute. He thinks U.S. equities may have topped and suggests that everyone consider gold. After it breaks through 1450 resistance, the sky's the limit. He's looking for 2,000 plus on the yellow metal. Then Wolf Street founder Wolf Richter makes his show debut. He thinks by the end of 2018, we might be nearing a new recession, and we've certainly seen one of the longest expansionary periods in U.S. history since the 2008-2009 Great Recession. But the echo bubble may be due to unsustainable debt levels. Most of my guests agree. And remember to call into our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. We're still offering free Bitcoin cold storage wallets to our new subscribers. So if you haven't yet signed up, send a request to me at gsr@hughes.net. Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies rolled in over the precious metal sector this week as investors worried a bit about robust economic numbers, suggesting that the Fed might pull the brakes a bit too harshly on their decision to ratchet up rates. The yellow metal shed just $11.70 this week, finishing still above $1,300 support. Meanwhile, silver was off 34 cents at $16.27. The precious metals shares index gave back 20 cents, ending at $78.70. But it was black gold that added 40 cents, finishing at $62.41 per barrel, one of the few markets to close in the black. And that certainly helped buoy the CRB commodities index, which is also treading water. The Bitcoin ETF gave back a fractional amount as well, closing at 1423, as traders try to find support around 8,000. Well, the top story moving the markets, given this week's consumer sentiment number hit a 14-year high. Numbers from the CME website indicate Fed officials have plenty of wiggle room to pull the trigger on a rate hike next week. The Fed funds futures contracts indicate about a 92% chance of a quarter point hike at the March 21st meeting, according to the CME group data. The markets have currently factored in about two rate hikes, one more in June, and then a third late this year. In related news, growing concerns over a potential trade war with U.S. trading partners continues to plague the markets. The proposed tariffs include iron and aluminum, which has increased tensions between the U.S., the U.K., NATO, and Russia. This Wednesday, the White House announced plans to reduce the U.S. trade deficit with China by $100 billion, again using tariffs. Precious metals, bottom line, and Bitcoin. Well, the robust oil market certainly helped the CRB commodities sector to tread water, and the technical position, though, on the precious metals a little less positive. Gold is testing support along with silver in the XAU, despite U.S. dollar weakness. This Sunday, Indians will celebrate the Gudi Padwa Festival, another gold-friendly event. And regarding Bitcoin, I remain long-term bullish, but traders need to hold 8,000 support this weekend, or it looks like a retest of the 6,000 lows is the next move. Heavy cloud cover appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week on increased political tensions and a shakeup around the U.S. administration. By Friday's close, the Dow was off 400 points, 1.5%, just shy of 25,000. The S&P 500 was off 35, about 2%, closing at 2752, while the NASDAQ lost 1%, finishing at 7481. Friday witnessed the infamous quadruple witching day, where stock index futures, options, and single stock futures and stock options all expire concurrently. This typically leads to higher price volatility and heavy volume. By the market close, the S&P 500 broke its four-day losing streak on mostly solid economic numbers and broad-based advances in 9 of the 11 key sectors. Energy led the gains, up 1% on surging crude oil price, and the tech sector failed to pull its weight, though, after breaking records last week. Meanwhile, stocks in the news Friday included American Express, ticker AXP, adding about 1.3%. 3%. Johnson & Johnson rose 0.5% on news that it received an offer to buy its LifeScan blood glucose monitoring business for $2.1 billion from Platinum Equity. U.S. shares, bottom line. Well, clearly, U.S. political worries put the damper on the indices. I think the market has clearly factored in next week's rate hike, and the 7-indicator Greed to Fear USA Today index dropped sharply back into the fearful category. It's a very positive event from a contrarian perspective, suggesting that U.S. share prices could advance in the weeks and months ahead, as the herd is very fearful, and the herd is usually wrong. Coming up after the break, more Goldseek Radio. Wolf Richter, a new guest in his debut appearance here on Goldseek, a top macroeconomist from Northern California. Welcome to the show, Wolf.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
You share the perspective of many of our recent guests here on the show that maybe some of the government's numbers that we're seeing not quite as solid as they would have us believe. Can you tell us some more, please?
Well, what I see is that the consumer is holding up pretty well in terms of consumer spending. So the retail numbers just came out again today, and they were up 4% year over year in January. They were up over 5% in January, and 4% in February, over 5% in fourth quarter last year. So they're spending. But what is happening is that they're borrowing a lot to spend this money. A lot of these consumers that are already vulnerable, they're now defaulting on their credit cards. So we have seen a surge in credit-based consumer spending, and that credit is now getting into difficulty. There's a delay in between when the credit gets into difficulty and when it will show up in the spending numbers, but that will eventually happen. Now, most of the American consumers are just fine. You know, it's the most vulnerable 20% or 30% that are in that category. We're seeing the same thing with auto subprime loans. One of the big reasons why auto sales are down is because of the lending problems and the credit problems in that sector. And subprime borrowers are defaulting in very large numbers on their auto loans that they took out in the last couple of years. And so lenders are becoming a little more prudent in lending, and so it crimps the sales of new vehicles. So we have seen the consumers are trying to spend, but they're having to spend borrowed money, and they're defaulting on they're starting to default on those loans, and the lenders are reacting by tightening the conditions, and so they're gradually going to make this increase in spending more difficult. Government spending, we're going to blow out of proportion now. I mean, 2018 will be the year where we'll see a gigantic increase in our national debt. The government will spend a lot more money than it will take in. It will have to borrow that. This spending will initially increase the GDP numbers, but it's based on credit, and we will see government borrowing starting to crowd out corporate borrowing, so interest rates will go up. They already have. That trend will continue. This will impact housing. Housing turns very slowly, but we've seen the first problems in pending home sales probably by the end of this year or early next year. This is how long it takes for housing to turn around. We'll see, we see the first price declines, year-over-year price declines in the housing market. I think we're at a turning point, and it's based on the problems in credit and in an economy that's completely dependent on credit. Obviously, the Fed is trying to tighten financial conditions. It's trying to make credit more expensive. It's trying to crack down a little bit on the exuberant borrowing that has driven this economy. So the Fed is, in part, targeting this credit-based spending. It's going to succeed eventually. It's going to impact all aspects of the economy.
So it sounds like you see this echo bubble since the 2008-2009 Great Recession. But of course, it won't be identical. We don't have the subprime risk that we had before with the all-day loans. But now you see a credit card. My guess would also be student loan potential bubbles there. Also, one of the reasons why this might catch the typical investor, maybe even the markets off guard a bit, is here we are just last week with the U.S. numbers, 17-year lows. of course, on unemployment, the national rate hovering around 4.1%. These are solid figures, and we added 313,000 new jobs last month in February. What do you think it will take the markets to reflect some of your concerns?
The bond market is larger than the stock market, so it's really the place where we keep our eyes. In the bond market, we have already seen some reflection of this, especially on the treasury side, and now on the high-grade corporate side. In the junk bond market, there has still been no reflection of any of this. The junk bond market is completely in denial. They're still trying to get the returns that they can get there, just ignoring the risk. In the stock market, I think it's been so ebullient for so many years that it will take a long time to make a significant dent into it. I think it will meander lower. I think the realization is sinking in that this is not the Goldilocks economy. There are a lot of pressures building up, particularly on the credit side. You know, I think this will eventually settle down, settle on the stock market, but it will be gradual. In 2007-2008, we had a financial crisis that caused the total collapse in credit, which caused freeze up, and even highly rated companies couldn't meet payroll anymore because the credit that they were relying on, the overnight borrowing, wasn't available anymore. And this is a situation that's fairly unusual. I don't see that, like you said, you know, I don't see that scenario play out again. What I see playing out is a much more common non-crisis where asset prices simply meander lower in some sort of volatile but orderly fashion that reflect economic reality as it's playing out. And we're talking about the jobs. Yeah, those are really good numbers, as you said, but there are also many, many Americans that could be working that are not working. I mean, one of the reasons why wages are really not coming up that much, the wage pressures are there, but wages going up a little bit and companies get more desperate hiring, and suddenly these other workers that haven't worked for many years may find a job in the economy. Right now, you're in the process of allowing some of the, you know, long-time unemployed to turn to the workforce. So in the theory, this is good, and you know, I'm glad to see that companies are hiring, but they're still basing this on credit, and I think in credit, that's where we see the weakness.
Exactly. I think you make a great case for a tighter labor market, but that also strengthens, I think, the case for higher rates. You know, we have the Fed funds futures now indicating odds of a rate hike next week, this time next week, the FOMC meeting, and then again, a second rate hike, at least at the June meeting, the odds also ratcheting up for the end of the year. So probably, you know, 75 basis points higher this year. That, of course, stresses the credit markets, as I think you've been really alluding to, and you have in recent interviews, including the Kaiser Report, seems to be something that might catch top institutional investors off guard and could stress the system. Any other areas that you're watching that you'd like to share with the listeners today?
Yeah, let me say a little bit more about the Fed rate hikes here. The three rate hikes you mentioned that are being priced in mostly may be understating the reality a little bit, because we have had several Fed governors now opening the door for a fourth rate hike. Also heard the first Fed governor talking about speeding up the QE unwind, so the shedding the securities on the Fed's balance sheet. So the Fed is getting really hawkish. And in today's sense, not hawkish in the sense of many years ago, but hawkish in today's sense. And we could see, if we see four rate hikes this year, it'll bump the short-term rates up by 1 percentage point. Mortgage rates are already at 4.5% or over for 30-year fixed rate. That will put mortgage rates closer to 6% by year end. And the housing market is not prepared for 6% 30-year mortgage rates. High-quality borrowers, you know, that's not the subprime borrowers. So those are the lowest rates you'll be able to get. The economy overall is not prepared for those kinds of rates. The markets are not prepared for it either. You can see it in the federal funds rate. You know, they're pricing in the next Fed rate hike, but they're got a little further out on the curve, on the 3-month and on the 6-month curve, you know, and they're starting to be a little less enthusiastic about four rate hikes. And it's not fully priced in. The four rate hikes is not priced in at all. Very good chance of happening with mortgage rates closer to 6% by year end and other borrowing rates moving, longer term borrowing rates moving up. You know, that's the cost of capital for companies. And they're borrowing money to buy back their own shares. They'll be more reluctant to do that. They're borrowing money to engage in other activities that are producing very low profits. So they'll be cutting those back. So higher rates have a way of filtering into the real economy that are fairly gradual, but very, very significant. Now, I wanted to add that because I think we haven't been through that in over 10 years, so we forget what higher rates will do, what consistently rising interest rates will do in an economy that has been, where the markets have been very buoyant, and it will unwind.
Exactly. I mean, we've been in this brand new world of persistent low to negative interest rates, especially in Europe, whereas I'm sure you know in Beijing, where we've had negative rates for quite some time for large institutions. But I would like to address your thoughts, though, regarding housing. We tend to watch very closely here U.S. housing starts as a leading indicator for housing and, frankly, as an economic leading indicator. A big jump, nearly 10% month over month in the annualized housing start rate. This is one of the best numbers in years. The trend is really solidly higher. We saw this figure roll over around 2007, the last recession, which incidentally, I think we're approaching one of the longest economic recoveries, which may also be from a contrarian sign, a negative. Do you agree that we may need to see it roll over before there's any type of trouble in the housing sector, which is one of the strongest economic engines that we have here in the United States?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, the housing industry, so there's two parts to the housing. One is just the selling part of it that we see the numbers constantly, so the volume sales and the prices. The other part is the construction part. And the construction part is much bigger in terms of impact on the overall economy than the sales part. And the construction part is local. So you have local jobs and you have local GDP that gets boosted by the construction industry. So this is really, really important in many cities on the east and west coast where we've had big construction booms of high-rise buildings, such as in Seattle or in the Bay Area here in San Francisco and in New York City too, and all over the major cities. There are very powerful construction booms. They're big contributors to the local economy and well-paying jobs and materials and people that work there. You know, they use the local shops to buy the lunches and they buy trucks and they buy all kinds of things. When that turns, so when housing starts turn and decline, that is a real indicator that the overall economy will take a hit. And that is a very astute observation that you just made. And it happens invariably. You know, it is so important to the economy that if housing construction turns and construction in general, that an economy will likely not be able to avoid a recession. In terms of home prices, I think right now a little bit of overbuilding is a good thing. And that has been happening. You know, when you look around in Seattle and in San Francisco and those places, they have been overbuilding a large number of condominium towers and apartment towers. The problem is they're all high end. The companies that the developers and the banks that finance them that are behind these are now having trouble putting them on the market and getting people to buy them or to rent these units. It's all high end and the high end market isn't that big. This will eventually impact the construction boom because at some point they'll realize you can't sell these units and we can't rent them out. Yeah, they're too expensive for the broad market. We can rent out some of them or we can sell some of them, but we can't do all of them. They will cut back and then you'll see some developers default and some banks take on those buildings and then they have to put those units on the market. And that's when housing prices will be impacted because those units will go for a lot less than what they might have been going for a year or two earlier. Yeah, so the construction part, I think it's really crucial to watch. When home prices are high, there's a real big incentive to build. And I'm not talking about single family homes, which, yeah, this is a slightly different market. I'm talking about multifamily right now. And that has happened. That has started happening a few years ago. And construction just boomed wherever it can. This has put a lot of fuel under the economy, which is good. When that turns in a serious way, I think we'll see the economy enter into a recession.
A great number of the existing housing stockpile here, especially single-family homes, were evidently purchased by the tens of thousands, by institutions and hedge funds and deep-pocketed investors. And so as you start to see their inventory hitting the market, I think that would be one of the red flags. I certainly recall something very similar in 2006, 2007. Lastly here, it looks like you're looking at things to start to roll over. Certainly by the end of 2018, you see some cracks in the economic foundation. When that starts to occur, traditionally people turn to safe havens. Will there be a safe haven, or will it just be the greenback they turn to?
When all assets go up together, which they have essentially over the last, with a few exceptions, you know, the last 8-9 years, there's a very good chance that they'll all go down together. And a safe haven is something that's somewhat counter-cyclical, or doesn't move up when the rest of the markets move up, but it doesn't move down. We've had some of that happening in precious metals over the last few years. I don't know that there are safe havens in that respect, because I think that's one of the biggest problems that investors face these days. Where else do you go with your money? Real estate, the housing, commercial real estate, has been driven up exponentially nearly. Stocks, bonds, you know, other financial assets. A lot of these things have been inflated with enormous power from the pure interest rate environment we've seen and the quantitative easing around the globe. Where do you put your money? I mean, that's one of the most important questions. And we used to have answers for that. You know, before the financial crisis, we had answers for that. Because there were assets that had gone down or were fairly stable, and you could put your money into those. In terms of currencies, you know, this is now a global thing. So, you know, or you get out of dollars, put in euros, well, maybe not. You know, or get into yen, well, maybe not. And this is a question, I think, to which we will not have an answer. I don't think there are any really easy to get to safe havens out there where you're not putting your principal at risk. So I think this is one of the consequences of inflating all markets purposefully the way central banks have tried to do for the last 9 years. That's one of the consequences, that they're all now inflated and you can't really rotate into something that would help you get through the next stretch. Now, people say, well, get into cash. And yeah, that has been a great advice when it comes to liquidity crisis, because in the end, the person that has cash can pick up the assets at fire sale prices that no one else can buy. You're the last man standing with cash. Everybody else is out of liquidity and you're the one that has liquidity. You can pick up homes and you can pick up stocks and you can pick up bonds, incredibly low prices. You have a lot of liquidity available to do that. That will give you that option. On the other hand, I don't think we're going to have a crash like we did during the financial crisis. I think this will be long and drawn out. So you might be sitting on your cash for a long time before you can deploy it in a reasonable way. And that is not a very appealing thought either. So I think we have a very unappealing investment environment going forward.
Still, it sounds as though the lesser of evils might be increasing cash. Take a simplistic portfolio, well-diversified with, of course, the precious metals modicum, at least to balance the betas. Raising cash across the board would present some opportunities in a liquidity crisis. I would really appreciate it if you'd tell people more about WolfStreet.com. Very low on the hyperbole scale, you might say. And you seem to do a great job at gauging, you know, some of the economic risks. Interestingly, in Northern California, also earthquake prone, as your name there indicates, you seem to give people maybe an economic Richter scale to gauge some of the tremors there. A really solid scientific view of a subjective field, the dismal science. Tell people more, please, about Wolf Street.
Well, Wolf Street is free. Anybody can go to it. We have a vibrant comment section, very well behaved. We don't cover politics, we cover finance, economics, and business. Politically neutral, so we try not to get involved in partisan discussions here. We try to just stick to business, finance, and economics.
Yeah, I want to encourage everyone to bookmark this site. You know, unlike many that are not carefully watched or monitored, Wolf Street has some great folks who contribute excellent commentary. And not many people actually put their information out there free of charge to the public. All right, Wolf Richter, we really want to thank you on your debut here for your excellent analysis. And please return later in 2018 with updates, because I suspect this will be another volatile year.
Thank you, Chris. It was my pleasure.
Top Trends researcher, publisher, of course, of the Trends Journal, who joins us today. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Oh, thank
Thanks for having me on. You know, there's a number of things going on, of course. Everyone's interested in where the markets are going and the geopolitical front. And on the geopolitical front, you know, we're seeing relations now simmer down between the United States and North Korea. And that's no surprise to us because, as you well know in the Trends Journal, we've been saying now, there's not going to be a problem between the two countries because if there is, say goodbye to South Korea. So we knew a lot of it was really talk because if North Korea was attacked by the United States and they retaliated big time, you have about 24 million South Koreans living in the Seoul metropolitan area right close to the DMZ. So you could say goodbye to South Korea and parts of Japan. We didn't see that happening.
We also hear that Japan is very quietly boosting its military budget and increasing its spending as well. So have been unnerved by this, you know, this repartee between the North Korean Kim Jong-un and our POTUS. Sounds like you think there might be an agenda, and a lot of folks on the blogosphere are pointing to, you know, some type of subversive agenda.
The kind of media that you're getting, you know, what, everybody should be happy that the leaders are going to talk. Wonderful. I mean, let's you know, begin it and end it right there, rather than people saying, well, you know, they're out tricking Trump, and isn't it? You know, grow up. I mean, you know, what, anybody ever go before a mediator? I mean, what's better, keep the lawsuit going or mediate it? So just to have them talking is, you know, should be all looked upon as a positive if, in fact, it does go through. And by the way, China is very supportive of it too, because China doesn't want a nuclear mishap happening near its country either, and they don't want all these nuclear tests going on. So it's a positive, and that the news is giving it a negative is where the media is, because nothing that they do now is really doing anything to promote unity. What they do is divisiveness continually. The Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. The guy gets poisoned over in the UK, and quote, they believe it was the Russians. What was it? A pope? No, he was a spy. A spy got poisoned. Is this any reason to start a war against this? When all else fails, they take you to war, and you look at that low life over there, and they're in virtually every country running the people that are running these shows are. You got a person like Theresa May in trouble all the time. Brexit problems. Well, let's get the people's mind off this really quickly. And let's blame the Russians for allegedly poisoning a spy. Who cares? And when they ask for proof, no, we're not going to give you proof. Just like there's never been proof that the Russians have done anything to change the elections in the United States. Everything is based on assumptions, not one element of proof. So going back to the geopolitics, what we're most concerned is about something going on between the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia against Iran. That's what we're looking at, not what's going on in North Korea. And again, when all else fails, they take you to war, and right now you have a failing government of Benjamin Netanyahu over there in Israel, who's been brought up on corruption charges. So the more that you bring him up on corruption charges, the more the rhetoric's coming out of Israel that we have to do something about Iran. And now you have a new CIA director, Secretary of State, Pompeo, who is very anti-Iranian, and he's very aggressive in more and more war talk. So those are the things that we're interested on the geopolitical front, because if a war breaks out in the Middle East, say goodbye to the equity markets worldwide.
You know, we're seeing a lot of shakedowns or shakeups in Washington, D.C., and you brought up the markets, and, you know, as usual, we see more volatility, at least in the past few weeks, in U.S. equities. It's been one of the longest economic recoveries approaching, we're going on 9 years now, as I understand it. How long can this economic rebound last? Give us your thoughts on the markets, please.
Well, again, we were the first magazine to call the Trump rally, just really a week after he got elected. To the high point, you know, the markets had gone up some 45% since Election Day. you know, when he won. And we were the first magazine back in September to say there'd be a 10% correction in 2018. And in mid-February, it did correct 2%. Of course, it's gained back some. But we believe the Trump rally is peaked. And what's keeping it not going into bear market territory, meaning a 20% or more correction, is, again, the numbers. And the numbers are very simple. What brought the markets up? Cheap money. Stock buybacks and merger and acquisition activity. Well, it's cheap money. And so now, why did the markets go down? Fear of higher interest rates. So, to make your point. Now, why will the markets not crash? The tax cuts that Trump gave the big corporations. And again, you go back to 2004 when it happened under George Bush, around 2004, 2005, when he allowed the companies to repatriate trillions of dollars in taxes overseas. Where did the funds go? Stock buybacks. Already, the first 2 months of 2018, stock buybacks are at an all-time high. So, because of the tax breaks, because of the tax allowances, you're looking at more and more money going into stock buybacks. It's not going into capital improvements. And indeed, it hasn't gone into capital improvements to a large extent, considering, again, go back and look at the corporate earnings in 2017, for example, which, yeah, the last quarter was up about 15%. It's not going into capital improvements, stock buybacks. So to answer your question, where are the markets going? The markets have peaked. They won't crash because of stock buybacks, and thanks to the Trump tax plans, which, by the way, according to the Tax Policy Center and other nonpartisan groups, 80+% of all of Trump's tax plans have helped the 1%. Go back to the markets. Depending on whose numbers you're looking at, between 85 to 90% of all the stocks in the United States are owned by 10% of the people. That 10% owns on average of stocks about $350,000 in shares. The rest of the stocks that are owned by the other 10% by we the people only average about $15,000 per shareholder household. So very small numbers. So going back to the markets, it's only helping the top. Going back to what you said about interest rates, when the markets began their downturn, it was because of the fear of interest rates going up. So now, as interest rates go up, take a look at home sales. Take a look at new home sales. They're going down. Take a look at mortgage applications. Going down. The markets cannot take rising interest rates. Again, what's keeping the markets afloat are the stock buybacks that are going back into it, the market, because of the tax cuts. They can't take higher interest rates, nor can the economy. Oh, I forgot. How about car sales? Oh, yeah, they're well down, too. So that's where we're at. If rates go too high, this market goes down.
It's a strange dichotomy because on the one hand, we hear last week 313,000 new jobs created and, of course, 4.1% national unemployment rate, record low, 17-year low. But they forget to mention wages are stagnant. The typical home is not benefiting, and you alluded to that. It looks like an economy that might just want to roll over. And sure, it's been plugging along. We just hope that it doesn't go down like we saw 2007, 2008. Do you see anything that might capsize the vessel?
Exactly, we do. And again, it's war in the Middle East. You're already looking at, you know, oil prices fluctuating between, you know, $65, $70 a barrel. You have a war in the Middle East, watch oil prices go, you know, up to $100 a barrel plus. And now you already have consumers with record low savings rates. What do we have, a debt rate? They're over 13 point, you know, you know, over $13.2 trillion in debt. So what's going to happen? They can't pay the debt now. Oh, by the way, that's the other things to keep watching. You're looking more and more. Banks are reporting more defaults on credit cards. So they can't take higher interest rates. And if they can't take higher interest rates, and you mentioned already that wages are not going up, so if you have a price spike in oil and destabilization in the Middle East, kiss the markets goodbye. You're going to see a crash that'll be worse than the panic of 08. It'll be the greatest crash since the Great Depression because of, again, the markets are overvalued by historical terms. They're near all-time highs, and they're over-leveraged, you know, the ETFs and other leveraging schemes. So they can't take a big shock, and war will be that kind of shock.
And I'd like to speak to your idea that, you know, most of America, the bulk of America, has not benefited from the great rally of 2009, if you will, in U.S. equities, because over half of the nation has less than $1,000 for any emergency. And even, I believe it's something like 66% have $500 or less in cash. And so they are, as you say, rotating through credit card debt. And of course, that makes all of us interest rate sensitive as a society. And rates are going up. We're going to see at least three this year, starting next week, and then another in June, and probably another in November, December. So, safe haven, people like to turn to precious metals. Do you see anything other than gold? Because you're concerned about real estate. That used to be the go-to asset.
Yeah, no, it won't be real estate. Everything will go down. You're already seeing again. You're seeing a slump in home sales as mortgage rates go up. But gold, of course, is on the pressure short-term as interest rates go up. Because the stronger the dollar becomes, the weaker gold goes. But still, it's the ultimate safe haven. And again, you're looking at gold prices. You know, they have not broken below that $1,300 mark. But also, they can't break over our mark, which is $1,385 an ounce. $1,385 an ounce. That's our breakout point that where it will go strongly over into $1,400. And our major breakout point is 1,400.
1,450, we're with you. And when that passes, are we going to retest the former peak highs?
It'll blow past it. When it goes past strongly over the 1,450 mark, we're looking at 2,000 plus. It'll be a Bitcoin bounce, and gold is the leader. And again, it has to break strongly over that 14,500 mark.
As we wrap up here today, I think I'd be remiss if we didn't just say a quick couple of words, you know, out of respect for, you know, Dr. Anthony West. I know that he was a colleague and likely friend of yours, and we've known Zeke West for 12 years here. Just a remarkable researcher and individual who would think outside the box. His work with Dr. Schock on Egyptology resonated with so many people.
Oh, yeah, John Anthony West and I worked side by side many years, even going back as far as my best-selling book, Trends 2000, and worked on the Trends Journal for many years as well. And he was truly an independent thinker, and he lived his life the way he wanted to live it, and no one told him how, and he thought for himself. A great man. Again, he contributed a lot to society and fighting against the establishment and in terms of exposing a lot of fraudulent information and doing his best to put out the truth.
So, you know, thoughts and prayers, of course, to Zeke West's son. Do you want to tell people a bit more about the Trends Research Journal and how they can pick up a must-read copy?
Yes, we have the Trends Journal, Trends Monthly, Trends in the News, each weekday night, broadcasts, and, of course, trend alerts each week, and all for $99 a year. Money-back guarantee, the only place you will read history before it happens. Thank you, Chris.
Neville runs Neville Adler & Associate, also editor of four leading stock advisory newsletters. Welcome back, Louis Dabbley.
Good to be here.
Great to have you back. Are you all in Reno today or South Florida?
I'm in Reno.
All right. Well, we wanted to start off with, you know, the top stories, obviously, on the market.
It is a pause that refreshes. Some of it's also because the FANG stocks had a surge and they had a kind of burp, for lack of a better word. But at the end of any earnings season, stocks like to consolidate, and that's all that's happening. But I'm very comfortable and confident that as we approach Thanksgiving, everything will firm up and we'll have our traditional early January effect where the market broadens out and we have a seasonal surge. Around the holidays, we gather for friends, family, football, food. It's a happy time of year. It seems to rub off on the stock market. So I expect a nice year-end rally and another early January effect, and I expect a good start.
You know, this rally since 2009, so many folks sold out at the bottom and just didn't participate in much of the rally. It seems like every new peak and every little pause, we hear from the same group of naysayers calling a top. Usually, everybody's bullish at a top. It seems like everybody's bearish here.
Yeah, they are. We had some divergences, though, institutional investors and retail investors. I got a report from Bespoke that showed some divergence. I think the biggest issue is that everybody wants a correction, but it's hard to correct when the dividend yields are so high. It's also hard to correct when the earnings are so good. We were all expecting a dramatic deceleration in earnings in the third quarter. Just to take a step back, first quarter earnings were the best in 5 years. Second quarter earnings were the best in 6 years, and we thought the S&P earnings would slow down at about a 4% pace in the third quarter, and they're running well over 8%. They're double what we expected. And now the fourth quarter earnings are going to be even better because the economy's taken off again. We do have 3% GDP growth now. It's in sight with strong business spending, strong consumer spending, productivity, higher exports, more narrow trade deficit. Looks like the Fed's going to have their last rate increase in December. The new Fed chairman's going to be, trying to get the velocity of money up. That's how fast money changes hands. So prosperity continues to spread and rise. And it's a worldwide global event too. So, fascinating environment we're in, but it's I expect more melt up.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the latest Navalier upgrades, if you will. Upgraded from hold to buy. Aflac, AFL, BHP, BP, the gas company or petroleum, and Celgene.
Well, let's start with Celgene because the biotechs are having a bit of an issue, okay? I like the ones that have the earnings, but I don't have any biotechs that have hit my radar. British Petroleum did hit my radar the other day, okay? But it wasn't strong enough for me to buy it fundamentally, although it's certainly a good stock to go bargain hunting in. Our firm runs a PEG portfolio now, price earnings growth ratio portfolio, and things like BP are showing up. Aflac, it's okay. Not strong enough for me.
BHP Billiton Limited.
Yeah, it's too volatile for me right now. I don't really have many energy right now. I have a couple terminal companies, but you know, energy's up because of the chaos in Saudi Arabia.
The uptrend or the breakout in petroleum, you think it's a little late to get on board that?
I think time of year where demand drops. Demand's going to go up in the spring. In fact, I'm headed to Malta because there's a lot of money sloshing around the world right now. Money's on the move because they have to turn over about $800 billion, apparently, to the government over there. So what's happening is that this is a temporary event. In the end, supply and demand rules the roost. I don't like to jump in just because of what's happening in Saudi Arabia right now.
And moving on to Prudential, ticker PUK, Phillips 66, PSX, Vodafone, VOD.
To me, Phillips 66 is fine. That shows up in our dividend graders and everything. Prudential's okay. It's a foreign stock. That's going to be more dependent upon the yield curve. It's flattened out here, so I'd like to avoid that. Vodafone's an interesting company. They're extremely dominant in Europe. I'm a little worried about them, so they're not on my radar at this moment.
Any thoughts on Twitter? Sort of a turnaround candidate. This is just from a sell to a hold. Ticker TWTR.
I love the Chinese Twitter called Webco. There's been the president of China did a corruption crackdown, basically eliminated all his opponents. Just made himself president for life. Twitter over here in America is a little different. If we want to know what the president's saying, so Webco over in China is so the people can gossip about what's happening. And here we just use it to see what President Trump's saying and some other people. Twitter doesn't hit my criteria now because the earnings aren't.
Any positive comments on either the XAU gold shares or bullion?
There was all these ugly rumors that the Saudis are dumping their gold, that Bitcoin is competing with gold. I think that I don't see the traditional people that have physical bullion running to Bitcoin. I think there's a lot of fake news out there, there's a lot of static. And I think, you know, gold's a fine allocation. And whether it's 4, 6, 8%, I'll leave that up to folks and their advisor. We prefer physical gold versus the actual, versus the gold bullion stocks or GLD, the ETF. You know, it's just there when the world ends. I think, you know, next time there's a crisis, gold will go nuts. Right now there's confidence in central banks. So gold's been a little more quiet. A
couple of ratings boosts here. BMY, Bristol Myers Squibb. And there's also Alexion Pharmaceuticals, a little less well-known. ADI Analog Devices. Any of those interesting?
Bristol Myers is okay for dividends. We have some positive analyst upgrades.
Do you have any comments on the general forecast projections on U.S. shares? We're looking for at least 24,000 Dow and then a consolidation.
Estimating 11% earnings growth next year, I think that's very realistic. Typically, the analysts are optimistic in the beginning of the year. They get more pessimistic as the year goes on. But we do have this nirvana environment where businesses are confident, consumers are confident, don't have a lot of inflation brewing. The new Fed guy, Jerome Powell, was really at the urging of Mnuchin here. He really wanted Powell in as the Fed guy. And I just think he wants them to stop their infighting, you know, just infighting on the Fed. They've been fighting a mythical inflation beast that has not materialized. I think we want to have a little bit more pro-market, pro-business Fed. That's welcome, and hopefully under Powell, they'll be a little stricter. But, you know, this is as good as it gets, and we've had a stunning year. Stocks are not going up as much as earnings are going up, and earnings are still forecast to steadily rise next year, so I think it's great. The only thing is it's getting a little more narrow. Markets always get more narrow as we go higher.
Do you see any other asset classes you find appealing at these levels?
Well, it's mostly the tech stocks, and it's mostly the Chinese stocks that are being added to the Morgan Stanley indices. There's another trick up my sleeve. We just wrote a little white paper about the Robo Rebellion. They're letting robots run our money now on Wall Street, and we're very worried they'll cause another crash or crisis because ETFs do not trade at net asset value. They trade at premiums or discounts. And we're worried that the possibility that they might all try to sell at the same time and crater the market. I'm not sure the robots have been programmed to measure the premium discount. Back in 2015, we had a 90-minute period where there was a 35% discount intraday on like big dividend ETFs, DVY, ETFs. So we want to make sure that we don't have any more trading glitches. Our biggest fear are glitches, mechanical things on Wall Street, so much a prolonged crash. We do have a cheerleader in the White House for the stock market. Obviously, President Trump wants to remind us how much wealth he's creating all the time. I guess he thinks that's good for him.
You talk about the flash crash 2015, 30-35% retracement. Think of the arbitrage opportunities. If you had lowball orders in through options.
You could have had open orders or you could have just been watching and placed orders out there. But a lot of that was caused by my neighbors here in South Florida. See, down here in Florida, people retire and they miscalculate. They miscalculate for their property taxes and other things. So we had folks borrowing on, taking out home equity loans to buy more dividend stocks, especially MLPs, some high-yielding ones. And there were serious margin calls on August 24th of 2015. So some of this, some of that correction was triggered by seniors being leveraged up to here in South Florida. So we wrote a white paper explaining that it was actually the title of white paper is the government caused the financial crisis in 2008. We're talking about how credit default swaps imploded and how there were investments leveraged 10 to 1, 8 to 1 that all imploded. There were a lot of politicians under the bus in both parties. But then we want to say, okay, well, here's what happens when margin comes back. And we cited August 24th of 2015. We just wrote a new white paper warning about the Robo Rebellion, we had another little glitch after Brexit where a lot of ETFs were trading, yield-oriented ETFs were trading up to 4% premium, and other ETFs were trading a deep discount. Well, Betterment, the biggest robo program out there, actually stopped trading that day, which was great because that was the right thing to do. But we're not confident that all the robots will stop trading, and we're scared that some will start to trade and crater the market. And we predicted up to a 70% intraday correction if it goes on for a few days. So it's a real problem. Again, people don't know that ETFs don't trade at net asset value, but on an up day, they're trading at a premium. On a down day, they're trading at a discount. I happen to know that. We're top-ranked in ETF management. It's pretty funny. although we're top 1% in ETF management in the past three years, and we got 4 or 5-star ETF portfolios, our stock stuff is so much better than our ETF stuff because we know what the ETFs are adding every 90 days. So at the end of each quarter, we take a lot of the smart beta ETFs. We know what they're going to be buying. We just buy ahead on our stock stuff.
Oh, you front run the ETFs. Of course, you don't know with absolute assurance, but you have a very good guess on what they'll be adding to their portfolios. You did mention leverage and, of course, real estate. A lot of talk about credit default swap volume increasing similar to 2006, 2007. People worried about this echo bubble in housing. However, if you look at new housing starts, that's my favorite leading indicator on the sector. Nothing wrong there. Nice, steady 45-degree improvement month after month, year after year.
Every housing market has a line. Above the line, it gets soft, or below the line, it gets weak, but the lines are moving up and encompassing more and more homes. Obviously, they're trying to change the tax bill, so your home's not going to be a big itemized deduction. So it might hurt some of the really super luxury properties, but that's not what drives the housing market in the United States. Very, very comfortable and confident that the housing market's healthy, the stock market's healthy. They're the biggest beneficiaries of the current low interest rate environment we're in. The yield curve is as flat as it's been in 10 years, and as that yield curve flattens out, the Fed cannot raise rates further. So the Fed will probably raise rates in December and be one and done, and that's it. And then the new Fed chairman will be more pro-business.
Fed funds futures currently indicate over about a 91% odds of a rate hike. So that's pretty much baked into the cake, I guess, at this point. And you seem to think that would be it. Tell about Navalier Associates and any services that you provide, contact information.
We have a management company. It's called Navalier Associates. It's headquartered in Reno, Nevada. I guess we're most famous for a fund that we run. We were number one fund in the third quarter. It was at 14.54. It's the Cavalier Fundamental Growth Fund. We're a sub-advisor to it. We're known for great risk-adjusted performance. We're a low-beta growth manager, so we try to get you smooth, steady returns. So if you go to our website, click on the risk-adjusted view of some of our portfolios, and you see we have the lowest beta, lowest max drawdown, lowest standard deviation of many of our peers. But we have very good absolute performance as well. We also publish newsletters on NavalierGrowth.com. We have to keep those businesses separate. Both the management company, Navalier.com, and the newsletter site, NavalierGrowth.com, have free databases for grading your stocks and dividends, your dividend stocks and your growth stocks. They're separate databases, but you can key in all your stocks and grade them. They're updated every week automatically. We're trying to empower investors. We also have free services like a free market mail on Navalier.com. It's my weekly market commentary of myself and four other folks that write for us. Very extensive. It's 20 pages every week, very detailed. So we don't want people to be alone out there. We want to keep everybody appraised.
Thank you so much.
Great. Great talk to you. Take care.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. We live in a world of misinformation and perception management. Have you noticed how the public vernacular has recently changed? How collusion is now opposition research? And how nothing burgers are often whoppers in disguise? The decline of trust is the biggest story. It is written between the lines of everything we read, everything we hear, and everything we watch. Trust is something that cannot, or rather should not, be tampered with. Why is that? Because trust is the single biggest communication shortcut that exists. Think about someone you trust. Someone who, when they suggest something to you, you accept without critical examination, because it came from that person, or, as the case may be, from that organization. However, that very same suggestion or assertion, if it were to come from someone else, you would most likely scrutinize, analyze, and demand proof, and maybe never buy into that idea or belief because you don't trust the source. Mainstream media, political leaders, activists, various organizations. Many of them have used up their trust with you and I and the public in general. Many of them are running on fumes or empty, wondering why distrust is growing and why they are no longer being believed. Speculation abounds about the just-announced U.S. and North Korea peace talks scheduled for May. In recent months, most every expert, pundit, or analyst has speculated about what they believe is the reckless incompetence of the U.S. president and how Armageddon is right around the corner because of Rocket Man comments and the like. Last night, just about every major news show was flabbergasted and caught off guard with the revelation that denuclearization of North Korea is on the table for discussion. Some are now speculating about possible reunification of North and South Korea, saying that's not likely or possible. True, maybe it's not. But what has happened regarding this topic shows the sharp contrast and results generated when one argues for possibilities or when one argues for limitations. Half full or half empty? You decide. But if we carry the possibility of this exercise even further, maybe we do arrive at a united North and South Korea. And then, what if that reunification resulted in a new free trade zone from the West to the East? With the growth of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the One Belt, One Road initiative, perhaps we are looking at what may eventually become the West's access and participation route into this rapidly growing economic engine of the 21st century. Only time will tell, and only if one argues for possibilities instead of limitations. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.